greedy Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Mel Valentin. And this is Fat Guys at the Movies.
That's right. Fat Guys at the Movies. We got Mel back. He's been on. How many times have you been on the show? Two or three times?
I think it's been more than that. I think it's been four or five, possibly.
I know I had you. I had you on the second real podcast the first time. So that wasn't actually Fat Guys proper, as we like to call it.
Ah, okay.
But you have been on at least twice before doing doing guest host duties.
Correct.
Like this.
Yes.
So welcome back, Mel. We'll get your information here in a second. Let's just go ahead and get through the paperwork. You can go to fatguysatthemovies.com and check us out. That has all the podcasts, and you can subscribe to us. We now have a donate button because we're paupers and we're asking for money. If you really want to support the show, send us some cash. Via the internet.
Not in envelopes.
Or in envelopes. I don't care. We don't have to declare that stuff. You can also go to iTunes and, oh, you know what? That reminds me. I should file my taxes. Anyways.
What?
What? Did I not file yet? You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys in the Movies and we pop right up. You can subscribe to all our different, subscribe to the whole feed. You can subscribe just to the Fat Guy Show, the movie reviews, Idiot Boxers, whichever one you want. You can go to facebook.com/FGATM and like our page because that's what keeps us strong. And you can email us at fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. We have an email to read today from one of our listeners. You can also leave us a voicemail at 740-205-6456. And we expect to hear something from somebody sometime soon who's not a creditor. Anyways, while I go file my taxes, because I may have forgotten to do that this year.
I think they were due last night.
They may have been. Yeah. You know what's funny, though? I filed state and federal several weeks ago, and I've already spent my refund. What's funny is I always wait to the last minute on local taxes, the City of Columbus taxes, just because it's the City of Columbus, and it's not that big, and I usually end up owe a little bit of money, and like this time, I mean, not much. I mean, we're talking like $20, but I just don't want to write that check until I need to, and then I forgot to mail it, and so I mailed it late. So I'm testing the theory of whether you actually have to have it postmarked on the day that it's due, or if you can send it in like a day late, and whether they're even going to care.
Or even notice, right, yes.
Yeah.
There's probably some grace period in there, I would think.
I would imagine there's not somebody there looking at postmarks when they come into the office and be like, oh, this was a day late.
So you had to fill out separate paperwork, you're saying,
yeah.
For city?
Oh, all three, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, city, state, and federal, yeah.
I've never had to do that. It's always just been state and federal.
Oh, well, that's different. What's funny is as complex as the federal taxes are, even for somebody simple like me who doesn't have I don't own like massive, I don't have a house in Monaco or something like that, you know, but the local taxes is always the biggest pain in the butt to do just because it's the most un-user-friendly application ever. So that's also why I file late for those.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Anyways, Mel, tell us about yourself. Those who follow the show and listen to the show have heard you before, but tell us, remind the new listeners and remind everybody else what you do.
I write for eFilm Critic, sfstation.com, and also Very Aware. In the past, I've written for Cinematical, Rest in Peace, and Movie Vault. And you can find me on Twitter most days, most nights, Theodore Fish, that's double F, and also on Facebook if you... I'm easy to find, basically. Online almost all the time.
Search Mel Valentin, not, what was it, George Valentin from The Artist? Was his name?
I believe so, yeah. It was actually very cool to see his name up. That was actually the highlight for me in The Artist.
That was the best part.
Seeing his name on the marquee. I'm like, hey, Valentin.
And you like close your eye and you like kind of like look at the Valentin and be like, that could be me.
It could.
So there you go.
If I was taller, had more hair, and only had a mustache, yes.
Yeah,
I didn't speak any English.
You know, you mentioned in on Twitter that you're a lot shorter than I thought you were.
Can we
disclose how short you are? You're what, 5'7"?
Yes. And that's stretching on my on a good day.
Still taller than Tom Cruise. No, that's actually shorter than Tom Cruise. Isn't Tom? How tall is Tom Cruise?
I think he's listed at 5'8", 5'9". So we're probably around the same height.
So a little bit taller.
And Jeremy Renner is also around the same height. I've been in the same room with Edward Norton, yeah. During an interview.
Is he short?
He basically clocks in about 5'10", 5'11".
Okay.
So he was a little bit taller than I expected.
That's me.
But I don't know if you've seen shots of Renner and Norton in the Bourne Supremacy. Legacy. And yeah, and Norton towers over him. So
yeah. Well, Jeremy Renner does not. I would expect him to be short. I don't picture him as a tall guy. Tom Cruise is one of those, and because Tom Cruise is that leading man type, got really early on became that leading man, so they always shoot the leading man to look taller.
Right.
But yeah, Jeremy Renner, you know, he's played what could be worked as diminutive roles before. So it's not, you know, he doesn't look like a Hulk in any respect of the terms.
But. Well, I find it interesting that, yes, they cast, usually, as you were just saying, they'll cast a female actress who's approximately the same height. Although yeah. I think there was a height discrepancy between Paula Patton and Tom Cruise, and they worked around that.
Well, she's tall, yeah.
Yeah, but then, so they found a male actor basically be the same height, so they didn't have to worry about eye lines or camera angles too much.
Yeah. Well, I was just watching, and I mentioned this on Twitter. I just recently watched. I watched the Iron Man movies, and I watched the Incredible Hulk. We're leading up the Avengers, and there's a scene where one of the Iron Man movies where Gwyneth Paltrow was walking with Robert Downey Jr. And mm-hmm. I was trying to see. You couldn't see her feet. I was trying to see whether she was in her high heels or not. Because
probably
I don't
not.
Know how,
yes.
I don't think he's that tall, and she's not tall, but with high heels. I met an actress. Oh, what was her name?
I always thought that Gwyneth Paltrow was tall. I thought she was in the 5'10" to 6 feet tall range. And you're right. If she's wearing 2 or 3 inch heels, heels.
Well, no, because I interviewed and I forget her name. She played the naked girl in another teen movie, and she was in Cabin Fever. When I was talking to her, we were looking pretty much eye to eye, and I said, "Oh, you're pretty tall." She's like, "Oh, let me take off my heels." She took off my heels, and suddenly she like came up to my nipples. I mean, that's
wow.
Like she just went boom. Serena Vincent,
oh, okay,
sweet lady, but yeah, boom. You forget how tall those heels are.
And how tall are you?
I'm five. I'm just under 5'11".
Okay.
Yeah. So 5'10", 5'11". Anyways, you know, we got to talk real quick about it. We're just going to do a tease on this movie because we'll come back and talk real quick about it. It's the latest Disney Nature movie. This one they didn't screen. They screened it for those in San Francisco, but I believe you had a conflicting screening at the time, so you
couldn't
go see it.
Yes, I was so heartbroken.
Yeah, and this is Chimpanzee, where they did Earth, and then they did Oceans, and then they did African Cats. Disney Nature profiles the lives of chimps in this Earth Day release, and as you know, releases on Earth Day, which happens to be a Friday. The last couple of years, it's been midweek because 420 is Earth Day. Ironically, 420, I don't know if there's a connection with something else that's 420. But on Earth Day, this release, and I think if you go that first week, you get the Disney will donate a portion of the first week's gross to a chimp habitat or something like that. But here it is, Chimpanzee. Listen to the trailer.
From Disney Nature. Witness the incredible true story of an orphan and the one who will raise him as his own. Discover the remarkable bond that will capture your heart. Chimpanzee.
Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. We left on the Chimpanzee trailer real quick. Mel, what are your thoughts on the Chimpanzee movie? Are you interested in seeing it?
I actually was. If it hadn't conflicted with my other screening, I probably would have seen it. Free and clear, I would have seen Chimpanzee. But that's only because of my love for the Planet of the Apes movies. And Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
I hate to tell
this
you.
This is not a prequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
I have not seen this movie yet, but I'm pretty sure that the chimpanzees don't rise up and kill all the humans.
Well, no, this is a prequel. This is before that happens.
Okay. This is before they give the mind-enhancing drugs.
Exactly, yes.
I tend to like the Disney nature films. I like, there's a couple things. I haven't seen Chimpanzee. They didn't screen it in Columbus, and I wasn't able to get down to another screening. I'll be checking it out this weekend, though. I've always enjoyed nature films. I love nature films when they're done well. And I mean, going back to when I would watch PBS as a kid, because we had nothing else. But I did, and I liked the fact that Disney used to do these nature documentaries, and they actually packaged them together about 5 or 6 years ago in their Disney Treasures. I don't know if they're available, and if they, they're probably back in the vault now, but you can probably get them online, but they're probably, you know, really expensive because they were kind of limited editions. I like the fact that they're going back and doing some of these natures, and Earth was kind of cool, and Oceans was not as good as Earth because Earth came from the BBC.
Oh, right. It was a shortened version.
Planet Earth, yeah, which is a beautiful, really? That's a just gorgeous series.
It is, I agree.
And then they did African Cats, which was interesting, a little more lighthearted and a little more kind of classic Disney, older school Disney nature type thing. So I'm looking forward to the Chimpanzee movie. It's I like the fact that Disney is pushing to get some sort of a documentary into major theaters, and it's not just these aberrant documentaries that are popping up. Even though these movies don't make a ton of money, I think it's a good move by Disney. Bravo to them.
Yeah, so. I think it's good branding too.
Yeah. Let's move on to the next movie. We're actually going to switch it around here. Let's talk about Think Like a Man real quick here. This one is based on Steve Harvey's book on dating. Four men are manipulated by their significant others to better themselves. And to think this was being called a movie for guys.
What is the problem with men of this generation?
Ladies, till you understand the mindset of a man, you are never going to win in the game of love.
Act like a lady,
but think like a man.
What are your short-term goals?
What are your long-term goals?
What are your views on relationships?
Who are you, Oprah?
I could use a nightcap.
She has this 5-date rule before I get invited up.
We like friends without benefits.
Mom, what is this?
It's the new read for my book club.
Family Feud, Steve Harvey? He doing something on the bus like that?
This man is a traitor.
They know all of our maneuvers.
This is war, gentlemen.
What are your thoughts? First of all, let me ask you this, because there was an interesting article on Vulture a couple weeks ago talking about how this movie's tracking so amazingly well. First of all, I question that data. Second of all, they're saying, well, it's meant to appeal to, first of all, a non-black audience. And they're aiming for a non-black audience, and they're aiming for a male audience. Do you get that at all from the trailers and the marketing of this movie?
I do not. I thought it was completely marketed to African Americans and to primarily African American males. I didn't see anything in the trailers to indicate that it was actually aimed at anyone outside that demographic.
You think it's aimed at African American men, not African American women?
Correct.
Okay. Because they do have the guy. It is.
Wait, they have the token white guy friend.
They have a couple white guys in there, but they are token white guys. Yeah. I mean, let's just call it what it is.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
think they're trying to market it outside of that market, but I don't think it's gonna fly. Because here's the thing, some of the biggest box office earners are black guys. I mean, Will Smith was a great example. We'll see how well he does this summer. But at one time he was the king of the box office. Wesley Snipes at one time was a king of the box office. Eddie Murphy, before he started doing terrible movies, was a very huge bankable name. The problem is if you look at the cast, the guys in this movie, there is nobody recognizable in this movie at all. You'd be like, hey, that was the guy who was on No Ordinary Family. Or, hey, that was the guy I've seen in a bunch of other shows.
Right, right. They're usually
movies.
Fifth or fourth leads and supporting actors. You don't know their names. Yeah. You might just know their faces.
Yeah, and so there's no name to that even. I don't think there's even anybody in this movie in terms of the guys that are big names in the black community either. I mean, they don't have... what's his name? Kevin Hart. And so he's got a bit of a name, but even then, I mean, that's just it. I mean, Kevin Hart's when Kevin Hart is the biggest name in your male cast,
you don't have a cast.
You don't have a cast. I mean, Kevin Hart had his little concert film last year that did extremely well, but even then it wasn't like a huge crossover mainstream success. Kevin Hart is very funny in the stuff he does, but he's usually sort of the sidekick in a movie,
right?
Like this.
And I actually thought that was his role in this. At least he's one of five leads, as opposed to being the protagonist, but
yeah. And there's one, there are two white guys in a bunch. One of them's a very side character, and the other one's happens to be dating Gabriel Union. In fact, the women are the bigger names, and even then, at Gabriel Union, she's probably the one that most people will recognize.
Yeah.
Taraji P. Henson is in it too, and she's been in a bunch of stuff.
Well, she's got a little bit of clout because she's on Person of Interest now.
Well, she's on Person of Interest, and she had the Academy Award nomination several years ago for Benjamin Button. But she hasn't quite capitalized on her career after that as, say, somebody like Nicolas Cage did. She's kind of done more of the Mirror Sword Me, you know, thing, and kind of done movies, but there's nothing that she's ahead. And it's a tough road for her because she's, you know, not exactly leading lady material.
Yeah,
just because she's a more poor petite. She's more sort of like the side character. Kind of, she didn't quite work her Oscar magic the way, say, Viola Davis did, and got some different roles. And then like Megan Good, who's gorgeous, but she's I can't name very many movies she's been in. And
I just know the name and the face. Although I think Gabrielle Union, I was always sort of disappointed that she didn't have a better career. Either on TV or on or in film.
Yeah, I mean, most people say "Bring It On" is what they'll remember her for, or
Bad Boys Two.
Bad Boys Two. So,
how can you not remember her for Bad Boys Two?
Those are your choices. but here's the thing: this is why I'm saying this is not a movie for guys, because I'm calling this weekend. This is Estrogen Week, because this is aside from Chimpanzee, the other two movies are for the ladies. This one is not. It may have guys as the main characters, but it's not a guy movie. Because what is it? It's about women who manipulate their men into doing a certain thing. It's about guys who change for their women. And that is not the kind of movie guys go to see. I'm sorry. That's just the way guys think. I think what it's really trying to do is trying to differentiate itself from the Tyler Perry movie. So it's not that gospel play, and it doesn't have that wacky Madea character in it, but it does very much play to a black audience, and it really plays well to a female audience. And I think the only guys who are really going to go see this are the ones who are dragged.
Yes, that's going to say the same thing. So it'll probably, but you think it'll probably do sort of maybe not top level Tyler Perry numbers, but maybe something a little bit less, more modest.
Well,
instead of 25, 30, maybe 15, 20 opening weekend, then it'll just die off by next week.
I don't see a whole lot of oomph behind this part of it. It's the competition it has. We'll talk more about specifically what I think it'll do in the box office segment, but I think you're right. I don't think it has. Part of it is just there's no one that anyone wants to see in the movie necessarily. It's not even like the ensemble comedies like they got What to Expect When You're Expecting that's coming up, which they throw everybody in. They're doing the Valentine's Day thing, but those had pretty big names in those movies.
Right.
This one, like I said, the names aren't there. With that said, having seen the movie, well, I guess Steve Harvey's in it too, but he's sort of he's the MacGuffin. when I saw the movie, my response to this one was, well, it wasn't terrible. It was better than I thought it would be, and it has some laughs, but it's still just sort of that, you know, woman wants to change her man kind of movie, and the man has to change for the woman, as opposed to just saying, the heck with you, lady, and dump her on her butt. So,
or find some middle ground.
Yeah.
As it happens in the real world. Right?
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's not a terrible movie, but it's not exactly a run out and go see. But, you know, I mean, I found some enjoyable things, but there are some laughs. You know, the ladies in it are attractive. Megan Good's gorgeous. Wow.
There's something to be said for that when there's nothing else going
on
in the film.
That's what I keep fixating on. I'm going to give this movie a kind of sucks, though. Sorry, people. I'm sorry.
I'll give the trailer kind of sucks.
Okay.
Since I didn't see it, unfortunately.
The next movie we're going to talk about, we're just going to leave you with the trailer of that one, and that is The Lucky One, in which Zac Efron stars as a Marine who comes back from war to fall in love with a woman whose picture he found in the battlefield.
I promised myself that if I made it out, I would find that girl and thank her for saving my life.
I'm Beth.
Logan.
What brings you to Hampden?
It's kind of a long story.
There's a man here who came to apply for the job, and I can't get rid of him. How'd you get him to leave?
I gave him the job.
You don't know anything about him.
Neither do you. 42 miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We are in the infamous middle segment where we can swear. Notice how I time this so we can swear and talk about dirty stuff during the lucky one.
But it was PG-13, right? Wasn't it?
Well, not what I'm going to say. Not what I'm going to say about it. You take first crack at this sucker. You tell me what you thought about it, Mel.
Well, if you've seen one Nicholas Sparks movie, you've seen them all. It's just a template, formulaic filmmaking. He just has it, you know? I mean, he's been writing novels for, what, 20, 30 years? He's published a dozen novels, and they're pretty much all the same. They're just cookie cutter. He just throws in a few changes, right?
Setting, age
of characters, maybe, and...
Well, you go. It's always beautifully shot in usually Savannah, but this one like it takes place in Louisiana. Same diff, you know. It's beautifully shot swamps and greenery and lots of weeping willows, and somebody dies. that's the Nicholas Sparks formula. I'm not gonna say who dies, but there's always a death.
And in one of the most idiotic segments of all time, but.
There is a certain formula as to who dies. Now, if you've seen the last like four Nicholas Sparks movies, you can guess who dies in this one.
But how he dies
there was just some foreshadowing early on. You used the pronoun.
He, she, it. It could be the family dog. Cover that one up.
You should run for office.
The movie is set in a kennel, so there are animals involved.
Okay.
I don't want to get animal lovers coming after you for suggesting that animals should be sacrificed on the altar.
Speaking of animals, can I reference something? You know, when you heard that Jennifer Lawrence, it's nothing to do with the lucky ones. You heard her; she got in trouble for saying "screw Peter." PETA. Remember that? Did you hear that story? What happened was when she did Winter's Bone. There's a scene where they skin a squirrel.
Yes.
But of course the story goes that they used roadkill.
Same thing with Hunger Games, right?
No, she didn't. I don't think she does that in Hunger Games.
Yeah, she does skin some animal that she eats.
Yeah, but I mean, I think they actually got a real... When you have a big budget movie, they bring in a fake animal.
Right.
In Winter's Bone, because it was so low budget. And it was dead anyways. They went ahead and skinned a real squirrel in that. And somebody was saying PETA was pissed off at her. And then she says in an interview, she says, well, screw PETA. And I was like, I thought, well, wouldn't it be funny if she was actually just referencing
PETA the character?
PETA the character.
Yes.
Anyways, go on. Nicholas Sparks and possibly dead something in his movie. What are your thoughts on, spoiler free, what are your thoughts on The Lucky One?
Well, like I said earlier, it's just one Nicholas Sparks movie after the other. And I guess it's comfort food for some people. Who keep going back to the films and making them hits and reading his books and making him, you know, a bigger millionaire than he already is. I read somewhere that he actually gives quite a bit of money to charities, which, you know, deserves...
He has enough to do it. I mean, here's the thing.
Deserves some credit.
I'll give you that. But it's like one of these things, if you make $50 million a year and you give $1 million away to charity, that's bullshit. I'm sorry. It's nice that you're giving that $1 million away. But there's a big difference than if you had like $2 million a year and you gave $1 million to charity. I'm not saying you have to do that, but I've always wondered about the people like, oh, well, but they give a lot to charity. I'm like, oh, okay, but... Do you realize how much if he wasn't doing that, and it is a tax write-off? So I don't know. It's good that people are getting this money that need it, but I don't necessarily think that makes you a better person. They just have a shit ton of money and they can give it some away.
Well, they can give some away and they can start doing what millionaire, billionaire businessmen have done for ages, which is give money away to schools and then have parks and departments named after them.
It could be the Sparks Park.
Right. Yes.
See, here's the thing on The Lucky One, and I noticed I paid attention to this because seriously, this movie just goes off the rails before the credits even roll.
With that horrible voiceover narration, I counted 7 cliches strung together in the opening voiceover narration in one sentence.
It's terrible, and it's the basic story being he's a Marine in
Iraq.
Iraq, I'm assuming. Did they actually say Iraq? Or yes, did they just, yes, it was a dusty desert place. And he finds this picture of this girl, and then he tracks her down when he gets home, and he kind of, he never gets a chance to say that he was doing this, and then he kind of starts working for her, and there's of course this love story, and she's got a kid and all this stuff. So it's the very typical Nicholas Sparks unrequited love for a while, and then having to, but you know,
but what? The secret hanging over them for, you know, yeah, 3/4 of the film before she finally discovers the truth, or he tells her, or someone else jumps in, whatever.
Yeah. This movie is straight up emotional pornography. For that is all it is.
Ooh, I like that phrase.
It totally,
you might have used that.
Well, I would say that about the Twilight movies, but I'll tell you, there's more depth and character in the Twilight movies than this movie.
Whoa!
No, it is.
You're saying something good about? Whoa! I don't know.
No, well, I'm not saying that there's a lot of depth and character in the Twilight. I'm just saying there's more. You know, that's like saying, well, okay, this guy who just beats up his wife is slightly better than this guy who murdered 15
right,
people.
Right, so on a scale of 1 to 10, 0 versus 1. Okay,
Chris Brown is better than Hitler, but that's just because he just punches out women. So so this movie, there is no depth to Zac Efron's character. And I noticed that, like, at the first
There's
part...
There's also
just,
no depth to his acting, but...
Well, no, but I'm saying everything he says, there is nothing to him. His entire existence is he's just a sort of like strong, silent type who has come from the Marines, who claims to like to read a lot, but he has one book on his bedside table, and he claims to know how, and somehow he knows how to play piano. And,
he's a sensitive warrior. Come on.
And that's the thing, but there's nothing to him. Whereas her character, Taylor Schilling's character, she's this teacher, she's this mom, she works with these animals, she's got all this depth and care. But he is just a guy who's got serious mental problems from having
PTSD,
been in the war.
Right? Yes.
Yeah, he's so troubled that only the love of this woman can save him. I mean, this is pornography. And here, I'm not saying that it's obscene. I'm just saying it's pornography. Now people be like, well, because I said this when I made some comment like this about Twilight to somebody once, and she's like, well, you guys look at pornography all the time. I'm like, yeah, but we do it with the windows closed and the lights off
by ourselves.
Shameful about it. Yeah. We don't sit there. We don't go together all at a mass exodus to a theater and whack it off in the middle of the whole thing. I mean, we don't have to now because we got the internet.
There was a time when people did that though, right? Right?
Well, but even then, they kind of hid in the back. You know, nobody stood up in the middle of a. I hope nobody stood up in the middle of those theaters and were like, "Yes, I'm doing it right now." Isn't she hot? Yeah.
So what do you think is the worst job? The guy who has to clean that up.
Oh, the jizz mopper? Yeah, the jizz mopper's bad. Speaking of masturbation, here's the thing with this movie. So the whole thing is he lives on her property. I'm assuming it's her property. There's this very
No, I don't think so, because he does rent it from a guy that you never see again. And the guy,
that's right.
And the guy tells, but it's so nearby that he can just walk there.
Yeah, he just shows up, and at no point does she ever walk in on him furiously masturbating, because he spent how long? He spent 3 tours of duty in Iraq, and he comes home and he literally walks from Colorado to Louisiana, which is going to take months, and shows up there, and I'm like, at no point, and he's just standing there and being cool. I'm like, no, this guy would be, and if he's really that troubled,
yeah, she's a good looking woman.
There's got to be some release, and I'm sure.
Didn't you love how there's a lighthouse in a corner of the photo?
Yeah,
and that's his clue.
So, and he finds it because it just happens to be conveniently shot from the exact same angle.
Right,
lighthouse on a website. It is. Quite easily one of the worst Nicholas Sparks movies ever. And those are not good movies to begin with, but this one is ridiculously bad. The acting is bad. The writing is bad. The logic is bad. There's this whole, like, sort of this legal storyline, this sort of subplot with a custody thing with her child. And I'm like, he didn't even go and, like, talk to a lawyer at any point. He didn't sit there and be like, hey, if this situation exists, would this happen? And the lawyer would be like, yeah, this would never happen in real life. I mean, it is bad. I'm not a lawyer, but if I can sit in the theater and go, yeah, this is just ridiculous. There's no way that this would wash in any court.
I think that's why he took the lazy way out and just had a judge involved.
Yeah.
You know, and suggested there was political corruption.
But even then, they're like, at one point, this is supposed to be this tiny little town. right? You know, it's supposed to be this tiny little town that this guy's family has all this control over. And at the point, there's like a scene in a church where like every single character that has shown up in that movie so far is in that church. And the church, it seats maybe 200 people. It is like at a point, they're like, oh, the principal of the school is there. And oh, there's this guy he talked to earlier. And oh, hey, there's this other person. I'm just like, does everyone go to this church? And so they have this tiny little church, but then they have this thing where she works at the school, and there's like 800 kids at the school.
Well, it could be a regional school.
Now you're making excuses.
I'm trying. Well, actually, you just mentioned one of the most excruciating scenes was in that church. I don't know how much you want to talk about it. You don't want to spoil anything for the people who are going to see it this weekend. But it was a really rough scene, and I couldn't help but think of The Incredibles. And that whole plot element that some people find objectionable about how everyone is special, so then therefore no one is special.
Yeah.
And the fact that this kid could not play that particular instrument and someone should have gotten up and told him to stop, that he was causing irreparable damage to their eardrums.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah. Well.
And everyone's smiling, and it's like, are they smiling, or are they getting tears in their eyes because they're in physical pain?
Yeah, I couldn't tell what the point of that scene is. It was a bit confusing. So, yeah, it's not a good movie. It's not a well-written movie. Oh, women are going to, if you have a vagina, you will just melt at this movie because like I said, it is the woman's fantasy of the strong, good-looking, protectful, great guy who is just there for you. And that's why I compare it to the Twilight movies. But if you look at everything he says in this movie, there's no depth whatsoever. Occasionally he'll talk about like what happened in there, but like there's this whole opening sequence prior to the credits or the titles where they show him in Iraq and how this picture kind of saves him each time. It lucks him out. That was called a lucky one. And then there's a point where he has to reveal, this is actually in the trailer. So there's a point where he has to, you know, explain why he came over. And so he goes on this rambling monologue, and I'm sitting next to another critic, and I look over and I go, I'm like, did he watch the beginning of this movie? Because that's not what happened. It just makes no sense. So and they have, there's another scene where he kisses her, is left for the first time they kiss, and he literally lays down the line, you should be kissed every minute of every day, of every hour, of every world, of every universe. I mean, just like...
that was a painful scene.
It was a terribly poorly written line, and it was delivered by Zac Efron, who couldn't quite decide whether he has an accent or not.
Well, he shouldn't have tried, for one. If you can't do it consistently, don't try. And two, there were actually moments, there weren't very many, I'd say maybe a handful, where he was almost credible as an actor.
Yeah,
close. He was close. He was better there in The Lucky One than other films of his that I've seen when he's not playing
I don't mind him as an actor. I thought he was funny in he was okay in the High School Musical movies.
He was
fine in 17 Again. And
right.
Even Charlie St. Cloud, as dumb as a movie as that was, he wasn't bad in it.
I didn't see that. I skipped that. Well, he wasn't particularly good in Me and Orson Welles, but a lot of that really had to do with his character. It was just a viewpoint character who's kind of a hanger-on and not particularly... It's sort of the same problem. Not particularly likable, relatable, and zero depth. Yeah. And he's the character you're supposed to follow throughout a two-hour movie.
Yeah. You're just like, look, he built up his arm, he's got pretty blue eyes. But there's nothing... I just don't think he had anything
and he's tanned.
To work with. Yeah, he was tanned. And he has a tattoo.
Was that real?
Probably not.
No. Yeah, there were a lot of magic hour shots in that film, weren't there? I think all of it was shot at dusk. You know?
The entire movie, like nothing happens during the day until suddenly the sun starts going down and shit starts going down in this town.
That's when he actually starts working and unloading the pickup truck, you know? And she's looking at him longingly from the window. And she's washing the dishes. That scene where she's washing
the dishes. The most erotic pot washing you'll ever see.
And I saw it in an audience, not surprisingly, that was primarily female.
And
even
people,
they were laughing.
People.
They were laughing at that scene.
Yeah.
There was nothing erotic about it.
They were playing it for laughs, yeah.
Well, the mother character or the grandmother character shows up.
Yeah.
I always love how they dispose of the parental units. Oh, they die in a car crash.
Well,
really, Nicholas Sparks was just not even trying anymore. If there was a time when he was making some sort of attempt to create characters with depth and layers, he doesn't care anymore, and he's just given up.
Oh, it's all cookie cutter. But even then, like I said, the Zac Efron character, he just didn't have, he had nothing to work with. There's a, what's the term? It's called the something rule. And it's about, and I'm showing myself by not remembering the name. It's named after a woman who came up with it in the academia. Basically, it says if very few movies will have any woman who can have a character with another, have a conversation with another woman, and not have it be about a man.
Oh yes.
Are you familiar with that rule?
I have heard it, yes.
I forget the name. But like, there's a whole bunch of movies that fail. Like for example, the Harry Potter movies fail. Because every conversation is either about Harry Potter or talking to a dude. And this movie, while there's discussions about other things than... I mean, although this may fail because everything they talk about are about either her dead brother or about him, or about her parents, or about her ex-husband, or about her son. So there's except maybe there's one scene where she talks to the principal about being a teacher. That might actually pass this test. But when it comes to him, there's nothing he says. He almost has no conversations with anybody, actually. There's a couple of voiceovers. This breaks its own rule on this one, in the sense of, he can't even have, it's like the opposite. He doesn't have any conversations with anybody that's about anything, really.
Yeah, he talks to a handful of characters.
Yeah. So, this movie sucked. So that's the official Fat Guys grade.
And I completely agree.
You completely agree with it. All right, well, let's move on. Let's talk about box office from last weekend. Were you surprised that Hunger Games won again?
Not at all.
No, I was pretty much seeing that.
Yes.
I didn't think Cabin in the Woods was going to do that. Although, I'll tell you, it made almost $15 million, which I think is actually a pretty decent showing for Cabin in the Woods. For an R-rated horror movie?
Yes.
That's very genre-specific?
It's solid. It's not as good as I would have preferred for a movie that I loved as much as I did. But I'm a horror fan. I'm a Whedon fan. You know, I'm essentially the target demographic for that film.
Yeah. I think what's the budget for it? Something like $20 million or $30
million? I saw 30, yes.
Yeah, it'll make its money back. It'll actually be profitable, which is a good thing. It's not going to be a huge hit. I was not expecting it to be a huge hit. I'm just glad it's not a flop.
Yes.
Then the Three Stooges came in number two with $17 million. Did that surprise you? Did you even see the Stooges?
I wanted to, but it was, again, one of those problems where they had three screenings on the same night, and I had to choose one. And
did you really want to, or did you...
There was a
curious.
There was, yeah, curiosity primarily. The Farrelly brothers, they faltered a lot in recent years. It was a passion project for them. So yeah, it was mostly curiosity. Plus, my father absolutely loved the Stooges, and so growing up, it was a tradition with us, my early years, to go to church on Sunday, come home, watch Three Stooges, watch Abbott and Costello. Some Lauren Hardy shorts. They would always throw the shorts together along with some, you know, an Abbott and Costello movie. So that was two and a half, three hours every Sunday. And so I really ended up loving those characters.
Yeah. So well, and here's the thing. I made a point to see it. I didn't see it before I reviewed it before I did the Fat Guys show. But I did get a chance to see it. And what's funny is it's one of those movies. It's not as bad as the trailers, because I thought the trailer looked just god awful. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was asked by a radio producer who I was going to do a... Because I wasn't on last week for his show, but he emailed me. He's like, well, what'd you think of this? What'd you think of the Stooges? And I go, well, surprisingly, it wasn't horrible. And I said, and I'm sure Fox is going to approach me to get that on the cover box of the DVD and Blu-ray. Surprisingly not horrible.
I would love that. Wouldn't that be great? Just treat it as a joke and just throw it on.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. The movie is not good. The impressions, the impersonations of the Stooges are pretty spot on, especially by the guy who does Mo. I'm not even going to pronounce his name. And Sean Hayes, who does Larry, is fantastic as Larry. And I love Larry. Larry's my favorite Stooge. Will Sasso.
I didn't even realize that was Sean Hayes.
Yeah, he becomes the character. Will Sasso as Curly, I wasn't wild about, partly because it felt like it was a role he wanted to play on Mad TV and they just never let him.
Right.
And here's the other problem. The Stooges, even though Curly was chubby, they were all short dudes. And they were all almost exactly the same height. when Shemp came in, he was taller, but Larry Moe and Curly were almost exactly the same height. Will Sasso's just physically too big to be Curly. He just doesn't, he can't pull off the cuteness because he's almost too big for it. So that's my only issue with Sasso as Curly. But I mean, they were great. And the slapstick was funny, and they had some nods to the classic series, like they broke it up into segments, so they had like the treated it like a series of short films, even though it was all one story. Mm-hmm. Where the movie completely fell apart, there were two big things they did. First of all, they added too much bathroom humor, and I love bathroom humor, but they never used bathroom humor in the old Stooges because of the code and all that kind of thing. So not that they wouldn't have, it just felt out of place in a Stooge movie. You know, there's a whole scene where they had babies peeing on each other, which got too much. And then they added this whole weird storyline with the Jersey Shore.
Oh.
And ouch. And it just reeked of them saying, let's be relevant. Let's bring in the Jersey Shore. And you're just like, oh, God, it's become a caricature of a caricature of a caricature. And it just lost me there. And then they had like Sofia Vergara in it, and she's pretty much stunt casting nowadays because she plays the same stupid character everywhere. Yeah. I love her on Modern Family, but I don't like her on Modern Family in other movies.
Or on Saturday Night Live when she did that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. I don't watch Saturday Night Live.
I rarely watch it, and I did for her, you know, out of curiosity a little bit.
Okay, there were two big reasons I watched Saturday Night Live. And they were
She essentially plays the Latina stereotype, and. Yeah. On Modern Family, the writing is strong enough that they can really send that up and parody the character.
Yeah.
But when she's essentially just playing that character straight, it can get annoying and offensive. And
Modern Family has an ensemble cast of, 10 major actors?
Yes, and that helps, too. That helps in a major way.
Yeah, so the Three Stooges, like I said, it's not horrible, but it's not good. It's not really worth
I'm sold.
The money. And I don't think it's... But I don't think it was a movie that... It was a big misfire. It could have had some interesting things, but it felt like a really great tribute in a community theater talent show.
Wow. So, okay.
That's what I thought.
I'm running out tomorrow morning. Before I go to work, there has to be a 7 a.m. screening, right?
Exactly. And then Lockout came in at number 9 with $6 million. That was not that good of a movie. I was really excited for it and just didn't.
I was too. I actually paid to see that, by the way. Because, again, it was screened only once and against two other films, and I had to make a choice, and that wasn't the choice. Yeah. So I went ahead and paid bargain matinee prices Saturday morning. Yeah. I was one of 15, 20 people in the theater.
No, that's not a bad showing.
And the highlight for me was actually seeing the Battleship trailer. Well, we got to see the Raven, Safe, Prometheus, which I loved. And just seeing that on the big screen. That was the highlight. It was all downhill from there.
Yeah. What bothered me the most about Lockout was the just horribly bad CGI. There's a motorcycle chase early on honest to God looked like a low-res render from a video game.
I couldn't believe they included that.
I was surprised at how bad it was.
Because the outer space shots didn't look too bad. You know, the shots of the MS-1.
Yeah, them actually going to the space station, that was cool. The sort of the climax, the skydive climax was ridiculously bad.
Well, the skydive, but then also, let's throw in a little Star Wars and have some fighter ships, some fighter pilots attack the MS-1. I'm like, really, you do realize you could come at it from different directions, right? From top or bottom. Where are the guns on just that attitude that they're still on Earth or in orbit, you know, gravity applies, right, left orientation. It doesn't. And they just basically, why not send in drones instead of piloted ships that get destroyed? And
you're like, it's like 2080 or something like that. You're thousands or dozens of years in the future. The other thing that bothered me about Lockout was, it was
only one other thing. I'm surprised. Well,
I like Guy Pearce in it. I thought he was funny. He was going against Maggie Grace, so it was like kind of like he'd like throw these great things at her, and she was just like, and just like flop down, because she's such a bad actor. But it's kind of like how I said where in the Lucky One, Nicholas Sparks didn't even bother to do the due diligence of the research on legalities of certain things.
Sure,
it was like this movie didn't even bother to research common knowledge about science. There's a scene where they go into a room and they lock themselves in. And then they're like, oh, because it's the president's daughter, so she has this medical transmitter that can tell what's going on in her body down on Earth. And they're like, oh, the nitrogen levels are getting too high. And it's like starting at like 20%. I'm like, whoa, stop for a second. First of all, atmosphere of air, the air has like 70% nitrogen in it. It's an inert gas to the human body. You could be in a 100% nitrogen atmosphere and it won't kill you. It won't even do anything to you. It's nitrogen gas. It doesn't do anything. It might as well have been a noble gas. What's dangerous is CO2. Everybody knows that CO2 is a waste gas. And my thing is, I'm like, they're just ignoring. They're not even ignoring it. They're just mocking science at that point, going, oh, we're just going to call it nitrogen because we think nitrogen sounds cooler than carbon dioxide. And
you think they just got confused with deep sea diving and the bends or something?
I don't know. Maybe that was what. Maybe they said, oh, we watched Jaws 2, and this guy got the bends in Jaws 2. So ergo, a space station 60, 70 years in the future, that's going to be a big deal up there.
Yeah, you think there would have been safeguards and backup systems anyway for those rooms, but...
Yeah, but here's why it's so ridiculous for people, because people, you might sit there and be like, well, Kevin, that's a stupid thing to focus on. Here's the point. Not only did they write the script, they put in all this stuff about nitrogen poisoning. Then they had to have everybody deliver lines. They had to build entire sets. They had to build graphics and equipment that said nitrogen levels, blah, blah, blah. At no point did somebody go to Wikipedia and type in nitrogen and find out that, in fact, nitrogen's not poisonous. There's a whole, it's sort of like when they had the racist twin robots.
I'm certainly thinking of that. Transformers 2. Yeah.
Transformers 2. And I did a radio interview in Houston, Texas about this, and they were asking me about it. I go, well, here's the thing. This is what's so stupid about it. There was a script. There were actors. They did voiceover. They animated these things. They had, there were 1,000 points at any point. Somebody could have been like, do you think this might be a tad offensive? They've got a gold grill.
Yeah.
You know, they've, you know, at no point that this made it to
they
the
look
entire...
simian. They look monkey-like, and their accents and the grill and their attitudes, and
they get to release, and that's when people notice it. And they're like, well, I never even noticed. I'm like, bullshit. Nobody at any point pointed out to you that this was going to look bad.
Animators had a design, you know, you had production staff, you had designers, concept artists for the robots, multiple passes at the animation stage, and you're right. Absolutely nobody. Well, I guess it's Michael Bay. No one says no to Michael Bay, and especially if it was his idea and if he thought it was funny.
That's the reality of it is people did point this out, and they were just ignored. I guarantee you, they'll be like, nobody will notice.
But Michael Bay thinks it's funny, and his movies have made billions of dollars. But one of the interesting things is that if you do go back and look at his films, and he did get a start with Bad Boys, mm-hmm. where you have stereotypical humor, all his films have stereotypical humor on some level. Even The Rock, which, you know, the African-American characters in that are soldiers, basically, you have that chase scene, and you have this character who just jumps off the screen, who's the streetcar driver or, you know, conductor. It's like, whoa, where'd that guy come from? He's just so big and broad, and the accent and the, you know, line deliveries. Yeah. Again, you know, you don't really encounter people like that in San Francisco, but Michael Bay thought it would be funny to have a character like that.
Yeah, which was the same character that opens up Armageddon. I think that's a result in terms of Michael Bay. We're totally off subject here, but in terms of Michael Bay, it's because Bad Boys was originally supposed to be for... Did you know this? It was originally supposed to be for John Lovitz and Drew...
I knew, it was a white Caucasian.
What's his name? I'm totally blanking it. Garth from Wayne's World. I keep wanting to say Drew Carey, but not Drew Carey. Dana Carvey.
It was for Dana Carvey and
John Lovitz. And then so what he had to do is he had to urbanize the script. So he said he had no writing budget. So he and Will Smith and Martin Lawrence urbanized it up. And I think he decided to do that with every script thereafter.
Sort of like a good luck charm, right?
Yeah. He's like, well, this worked on Bad Boys. Let's make racist robots now. anyways, what do you think is going to win this weekend?
Competition's really slim, so I think Hunger Games just might slip through for another week.
Really? Yeah. You really think? Because it dropped 36% last weekend. If it drops just 30%, you're still...
It's going to be lucky. It's like going to be Lucky One or million. Hunger Games, and it's going to be very close.
I don't think so. I think it's going to be Lucky One by a mile. Really? I think Lucky One's going to be 30 to 40 million.
Because I'm saying 20 to 25. Movies. I'm going to say 20 to 25.
Okay. I think we'll see. I don't think the Hunger Games is going to. Hunger Games will be like 15.
Right. Yeah. So.
I think Three Stooges are going to drop like a stone. I think Cabin in the Woods is holding better during the week. I think Cabin in the Woods actually might hold decently, simply because there's nothing else out there like it. I think that Think Like a Man is going to get crushed, because the only people are going to go see this are black women, and every other person with a vagina is going to be going to see The Lucky One, The Hunger Games. Which, do you know what? Here's the thing. This is what's so sad. Dear John was the movie that knocked Avatar off the number one spot.
After how many weeks in a row, though?
After like 7.
Yeah.
Or 8 or something like that. And it's going to be The Lucky One that's going to knock The Hunger Games off the top spot. So now there's idiots in Hollywood who are being like, oh, Nicholas Sparks, box office mojo guy, he makes tons of money. It's like, well, if you release a Nicholas Sparks movie several weeks after a big movie has been a juggernaut, that's what's going to... It's a timing issue. That's not because those movies necessarily trump those films. So, yeah, I think it's going to be 30 to 40 million. I think you're going to see Vow numbers. This, even though The Vow wasn't a Nicholas Sparks movie, it might as well have been. It
was Sparks-like, yes.
Nobody dies in it, but that's it. You know?
But it was based on a true story.
Yeah, do you know how much it was based on the true story?
Very little, I assume.
Very little. Speaking of true stories, you heard the whole thing where Titanic, people were like, Titanic's real?
Yes, I saw the tweets, and I saw...
The story about the tweets.
The story, and yeah, some screen grabs of tweets that just were absolutely shocking.
Well, you know why I think... I have a theory as to why that's true, why that's happened. Every movie, no matter how loosely based on a true story it is, it always says, based on the incredible true story. Do you know they never did that with Titanic? They never say, based on the true story. Because when they were marketing, when they made Titanic in 97, and when they re-released it, no one has ever said it thinking, we need to remind people that this is a true story.
Right. Well, and it was always very clear that it was a fictionalized story about two lovers, and the lovers were fictional characters.
Yeah. But I mean, well, but that's never stopped Hollywood from saying, based on a true story.
No, you're absolutely right. So, and I mean, you're right. Also, like, I never thought of that. That there was no need at the time.
Like, for example, I don't think, like, there are certain things. Like, I think if they did when they made the movie Ray, I don't think they said based on a true story, because it's a freaking biopic. Of course, it's based on the life of Ray Charles. So I think what happened is that people are so conditioned. Some people are so conditioned to that because it wasn't advertised that way, they just didn't think that. And they're like, oh, Titanic, because they're aware. Obviously, they're aware of Titanic, but the cover box of all the home video products does not say based on the incredible true story.
Well, my other question is, well, I guess it's never even covered in history classes anymore at all, usually, in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I remember it being mentioned, not a lot of time, but when you start talking about, you know, the Industrial Revolution and early 20th century and right before World War I, That usually deserves a couple paragraphs. The Titanic does.
Yeah. Well, my experience when I was in school, and I mean it's very different now because I went to school 25 years ago, but we went to high school 25 years ago. My experience was whenever we did a history class, whether it was American history or any sort of history class that went for the full year, we spent a lot of time on all this stuff, and then like we whipped through the 20th century in like a week because they were always building the foundation and that sort of thing. And then it would hit like, you know, sometime in like May, like around Memorial Day, we're like, okay, 1900. And then we'd go through it in like a week. So I think they like focus on it has nothing to do with a war. So usually they base history classes on when wars happen.
Sure.
And they're like, okay, World War I, World War II. And then they're real focused on Vietnam when I was in high school.
Oh, but, likewise. Know. But in my case, it was pretty much American history was split up, you know, essentially into two halves, even though we had quarters or semesters, American history 1 and 2. And the first half was up until the, you know, the end of the 19th century, and then the 20th century got covered in the second half, which was basically half a year. So when I, in my wonderful Catholic high school that no longer exists, we went pretty in depth into it. I have to say that, we had some good history teachers, or I did anyway, and spent a lot of time on, you're right. I mean, it really always came back to the wars as the major events.
Yeah.
But we spent a lot of time on World War One and the involvement and, you know.
I mean, I was aware of Titanic. There was always a Titanic, because part of it is, but I was always presented, whenever I saw it in classes, it was always presented as the hubris of human nature.
Correct.
The whole, the unsinkable ship. And because as tragic and awful of a story as it was, it is a great learning experience.
Right.
To say, don't go walking around saying this ship is unsinkable, blah, glug, 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 you know.
On its maiden voyage. And you're right, you get that, on its maiden voyage. And I also remember watching A Night to Remember as a kid, probably on PBS.
Okay.
And that really struck a chord with me. So I, you know, and that was based on a true story and based on historical.
But did they say based on a true story?
No, I'm sure they didn't. But by then I already knew that the Titanic was a real story.
Yeah. I just think, here's the other thing. When it comes to Twitter, you can find idiots saying anything.
Exactly. Well, that's also the other issue, is that
there's 50 million people on Twitter or something like that. And
anyone with an internet account and a computer and a connection can get
so just,
on.
So just because you have several thousand people saying dumb things does not mean that it's representative of a generation or a type of person or anything like that.
I agree. Or at least we hope.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's move on. We got a listener email. This is something. It actually came in last week, but we had recorded right before it came in. So we're gonna save this. That's actually good, because you've done plenty of interviews as well. This comes from Steve Gabe, and here I'm just gonna read it out. How does a film critic / reporter handle an interview or a one-on-one at a press screening of a terrible movie and or performance? Have you ever been in the situation where you've had to interview somebody whom you knew the project or performance stunk? And if so, how did you handle it? Or how would you have wanted to handle it given no boundaries? Example, you're at a press screening for Jack and Jill, and they're allowing the press to interview the stars following the screenings. Do you bite your tongue and remain professional, or do you let them have it? Mel, what's your experience on interviewing people when you've hated the movie?
Well, I've been really fortunate, I guess, in the sense that I haven't had that experience. Nothing with hate. I always like to ask, before confirming an interview, to see the film, whether it's by a screener or hopefully the screening. There's enough advance notice. And I think there's only been one or two times out of all the times I've been, you know, I've had the opportunity to interview talent where the movie was so bad that I just didn't want to be involved with it. And I felt physically, I felt like it wasn't a good choice for me to go in there and do the interview, because I had nothing positive. Other times, even though I thought the movie was mediocre, and that's sort of the vast number of films that come out in any case, I try to find something positive to focus on. Because, you know, there's a human being at the other side of the table or wherever you're interviewing them, and they put a lot of, you know, time and effort, maybe not a lot of talent. Something went wrong along the way. So, and that's part.
Or if they're an actor, I mean, it's not the actor's fault if the entirety of the movie's bad. It's not
correct,
the actor's
right.
fault if the script's bad.
So, it's and a director may not have
great
written,
actors are in shitty movies.
And a director might be a work for hire guy who, you know, he's just trying to, you know, get a better project lined up, you know, where he can really show what he can do. I mean, just one classic example to me is Curtis Hanson, director of L.A. Confidential.
Yeah,
he did basically some, you know, B-level films up until he got there. You know, I think he did The River Wild or Meryl Streep.
I like The River Wild.
It's not a bad film, but you don't sit back and see The River Wild and go, that's a talented director. That's a guy whose name means something to me, so his next film, I'm going to go track it down and watch it.
Sure, okay.
So there's, you know, the combination of talent and script, or, you know, and acting and budget and studio interference. I mean, actually, one of the times I felt the worst is not that I've interviewed anyone, but really taking Jonah Hex to the woodshed in my review and dissing, criticizing a director as being inept, incompetent, later finding out that the movie was taken away from him and it was heavily edited.
Yeah.
And he was sort of the second director who was actually attached to the project. So it wasn't his film. It wasn't the cut that he released or he wanted released. I don't know if it would have been better or how much better. So I think we always have to keep in mind that directors, unless they're really indie directors, independent directors, who are making films with their own money or with very limited studio interference, they are, you know, just like everybody else, they are employees of a studio. Yeah. So I think that tends to sort of lessen my criticism of them. Or maybe the tone. You know, yeah. You can still get into some of the issues or problems with the film, but you don't have to be outwardly aggressive or antagonistic toward them. Yeah. I think.
Here's my take on it. I've done plenty of interviews. I've interviewed musicians. Even when I worked on a paper, I interviewed musicians. I interviewed circus performers. I mean, I interviewed everybody that came across my desk. And sometimes it was filmmakers. Especially now, I do more filmmakers. It's easier when you love the film. I mean, I recently interviewed Drew Goddard and Kristen Connolly for Cabin in the Woods, and it was a blast because I loved the movie. I thought it was a great movie, and we had we could have some fun with it. But to answer the question, first of all, you just got to be professional. I mean, you don't be a dick.
Correct.
You don't go into the interview and say to the guy, "I hated this film and it sucked and I think you're a douche," you know, because first of all, you're going to get a shitty interview out of that. But on the same token, you expect them to be professional about it. I did an interview. I did a round table. I was on a press day for the movie Kit Kitteridge, An American Girl. And we interviewed Joan Cusack, and wow. She came, and we had about four journalists in the room with her, and this is where she made a mistake, and this is not necessarily, I'm not dissing Joan Cusack, I'm just using this as an example. She says, "So what'd you guys think of the film?" And it was just, nobody expected that, because you usually don't ask that. It's like a lawyer asking his client if he did indeed do the crime.
Right.
And we're like, it was nice because it wasn't a terrible movie, but it's not a great film.
Right.
You know, so in general, you hope that the talent that you're interviewing isn't going to ask you point blank, because that's a dumb thing to do, because you're going to run into somebody who didn't like it. Even the most popular movie in the world, you're going to find somebody who didn't like it. So you expect them to, but I focus on the positive. I focus on their performance, and I can ask a lot of questions about a performance. Even if I objectify them, I make myself more objective about it. I'll say, well, you know, what were your choices for doing this? What about this? What about that? I mean, the worst that ever happened to me, I actively hated the film Funny Games. I've never seen the original, but the American remake, and I interviewed Michael Haneke, and it was also awkward because we were working through a translator for part of it because he's German, and so he doesn't speak English very well. And one of the questions, and I asked him a question because I was asking him about something in the movie that had changed, cell phones had become more prominent between him making these two movies. And I was asking him specific questions because I'm like, I didn't quite get this. And he kind of got pissed off when I was questioning the movie. He did get kind of abrasive. Now, I hated the movie. Hated it. It was my worst movie of that year. But I didn't start the interview by saying, "Tell me about your shitty film."
Right. And I didn't see that the American remake, because I saw the original, and that was more than enough for me. Mm-hmm. There's just absolutely no, and every indication I had afterward was that it was practically a shot-for-shot remake, just done with an American, you know, audience or American
in
actors
English language,
in English language. And
so I don't think for me it doesn't really become an issue, because I've interviewed musicians that I don't particularly like their music, but you can ask questions about it. Do your research. That's part of it, and ask the questions. And you know what? If they tell you point blank, just. Treat it like you're at a friend's house and their kid was in a terrible play and they ask you what you thought of the play. And you find something nice, because every movie has something redeeming about it. Maybe maybe it's beautifully shot or something like that. But ask the questions that you think the audience is going to like. So it's incredibly unprofessional to give it to them. I mean, if I interviewed Adam Sandler after Jack and Jill, I wouldn't be like, "Why'd you make this fucking movie, douchebag?" I would be like, why did you choose this particular project? What were the challenges of playing dual roles? You know, how'd you get Al Pacino on board, and how did you get him to do such crazy stuff in this movie? This is stuff that you can ask. Even if you hated every minute of the movie, you can always find questions to ask if you're a good journalist. So that's my answer to that.
It's a great answer.
Cool.
Although it did. Do you have a moment to?
Yeah, expound.
I mean, it's actually not my experience, but another journalist, another writer had that experience with none other than Glenn Close. with Albert Nobbs, and that actually did throw him for a loop because she asked him point blank. It's her, and you could tell
it was a passion project.
It was a passion project for her. She had worked on the original version. She was co-producer, co-writer, I think. So she did ask him point blank, "What do you think of Albert Nobbs?" And he didn't care for it. So he tried to dance around it. She realized that he was being polite. So she actually sort of pinned him to it, and it turned into her asking him 5, 6, 8 questions before she finally realized that, you know, he was there to interview her and gave him additional time to.
But was she cool about that? I mean, when she found out that he didn't like it, or did she get offensive?
No, I don't think she got offensive, but I think she was so attuned to her film and his not quite positive praise of it. Because he talked about the performances as opposed to the actual story, you know, and that was enough for her to realize, oh, he didn't really care for it, you know, and plus he was hesitant.
The costumes were nice.
I'm sorry?
The costumes were nice.
Yeah, right, yes. The shots of the food were great, you know.
Well, you know what's funny is where I've actually run into more problems is on a social media thing like Twitter. Or publishing a review. The way, when it comes to the internet has opened us up very positively in some ways, but also ways that you don't expect. There are times when I'll write reviews and I will get feedback. I wrote a review, my review of Hidalgo, which is that horse racing movie with Viggo Mortensen, and I basically questioned the validity of the actual that actually happened because I was reading up on it. And a lot of times when there's something that says based on a true story, I'll look it up to see, is this actually true? And I basically question on whether this thing happened. And I get an email from the screenwriter.
Nice.
It just says, I think it says the movie or something. The subject line was very cryptic. And then it was just a link. It was basically a link to his website talking about the true story of this. But I'm like, wait a minute. I found this whole other page that talked about, was there really a race in Arabia? There's no record of it. And whatever records we could find, there was no American horse that came over. There's no horse of this color, no horse of this breed that raced in anything at any time of any of these long races, blah 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 blah. So I'll get that, but more often than most often what happens is with smaller movies, because those are real passion projects. And in fact, this happened actually very recently. Have you seen the movie Absentia?
No, I haven't.
It's a very low budget, micro budget horror movie. It's released by Phase 4 and it made a lot of good buzz from especially horror critics like Bloody Disgusting, I think, in Dread Central gave good write-ups of this, and it's gotten a lot of good buzz, and it's not a bad movie. It's about this woman whose husband's been missing for years, and she's trying to put an end to this, and they find out that maybe he didn't just disappear, he was captured by some entity or this thing. It has some real creepy elements to it. Doug Jones is in it. He's the biggest name involved, and he, of course, plays this weird guy who shows up. I got sent the movie. I watched it, and I'm like, eh. It was okay, but it was sort of, it fell into the trappings of independent film, of micro-budget film, where you knew they did not have much budget at all, and they didn't have creature effects.
Right.
So they hid all the things, and you can do that, but at some point you got to have a payoff, and they never give you a payoff. And so it's just like, oh, that's the gimmick. You're just not going to show anything. That's fine. It's one of those movies I think could actually be remade on a minimal budget, but would be much more effective as opposed to just reshooting it. And it they used a camera that worked really well in low lights. And I find this a lot in independent films where there's like this 10% of the shots are just beautifully constructed, and the lighting's perfect, and they really set it up well. And then the other 90% not much thought is put into it because they realize they have 90% more of the movie to shoot and they just put it on a tripod kind of thing. So I watched this movie and I tweeted out, I'm like, I didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. And like within 10 minutes, 20 minutes, the director tweets me back and he's like, well, we didn't have that much budget. I'd like to see you do the same. And I'm like,
oh, that's always the worst response.
And I'm like, I was doing filmmaking 10 years ago, and I know you can light with minimal lighting, and there's choice. You know, I said, I've done it before. He's like, where can I see your movie? I go, I never sold it. Sorry, you did better than I did, but I'm a critic. This is the way it is. I don't think, and he's like, well, we only had this much budget. I go, doesn't, you know, I don't care if it was $70,000 or $70. the script wasn't that strong. And I said, we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this one. You know, I was trying to be polite about it, but it's the independent filmmakers that'll jump on you on Twitter because they're trying to promote their movie, and they do Twitter searches for any mention of their movie. So yeah, that happens more often than anything else, because you put on social network and you mention somebody's film, especially if it's a name like Absentia, that's easy to search for.
Correct. Yes.
Then suddenly you do run the risk of any time you criticize a film to have that, or a fan of the film, jump your shit. So that's when people jump my shit. Shall we do the Fat Guy Five?
Must we?
We must. Yeah, we'll blast through it.
Okay.
We had considered a bunch of them. We thought about saying what would be the five animals we'd want to see profiled in the next Disney Nature movie, but it was like raping dolphins and stuff like that. So.
No, orangutans.
Raping dolphins and orangutans. See, you didn't listen to the episode.
Sex or something?
That happens. You didn't listen to the most recent episode where I had Elizabeth Rapp on and we were talking about raping orangutans, because she's a big orangutan fan, and she was very disturbed that I told her that. I'm like, hey, they like a little bit of rape now and then. You know?
Oh, I really didn't want to imagine that. Ever.
What did I figure out? I figured out that you have a greater chance of being raped by a dolphin than being struck by lightning or something like that. Or just about the same chance. I mean, it's minuscule, but it's the same. Anyways, we've settled on the five worst Nicholas Sparks movies, because we can do the five best. aren't five best. The best one, which is number five, which is The Notebook. And that's actually his first book he wrote, too. So
Wasn't his first book? But it wasn't the first film adapted from one of his books.
No, the first one was The Message in the
Bottle. Yes. So, Kevin Costner and Robin Wright Penn. Yeah. Oh, sorry. No longer Penn.
Just Robin Wright. But yeah, The Notebook, it's not a great movie, but in terms of Nicholas Sparks movies, it's better than them all.
It's absolutely at the very top. Yeah. Well, and that's an example of having really talented actors elevating material.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it had the more complex characters to it, even though I had problems with it. But what's the next one on the list? This was yours, because you actually saw at least part of this movie.
What was the next one?
Number four, Walk to Remember?
Walk to Remember. Well, that's one I've never been able to actually finish. I've come across it multiple times and watched snatches of it, but it does have Mandy Moore in it.
Yeah.
10 years ago, you know?
Yeah. I'd look at snatches of Mandy Moore.
You were snatches.
Mandy Moore's snatches. What?
And
what?
Shane, and the co-lead was Shane West. And do you remember where Shane West also appeared? I think besides House.
Well, no, he was in ER, wasn't he?
He might have been. I don't recall.
He does mostly TV stuff.
Yes, he does mostly TV stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there was another movie that he appeared in.
What was that?
That you actually hate. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
I didn't hate that. I thought that
was Tom
just
Sawyer.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a guilty pleasure of mine. Yes,
it's not as good as it should be, but it's better than it really most people give it credit for.
I think it's just as bad or worse than people think it is, but it's all the more fun for that.
When I wrote for Film Threat, I gave it like a 2.5-star review, and they mentioned in a article once, they said, well, Kevin Carr's mutant power is to like bad movies.
Come on. And you know what? It was such a strong enough film that Sherlock Holmes 2 actually ripped off the Moriarty plot wholesale from it, which I found actually shocking that they couldn't come up with something better for Moriarty in the sequel. But
I don't think
about
anyone
him
remembered. I think they were kind of safe. They just, nobody remembered it.
It's only 8 years ago.
Well,
I guess when you're remaking Spider-Man 5 years later, right?
Yeah, yeah. The next one in the list is The Last Song. That's the one with Miley Cyrus. It is really, I mean, they're splitting hairs on this one. The Last Song's the one with Miley Cyrus and Greg Kinnear. Greg Kinnear dies in it. Next one.
What?
Is,
you just spoiled it. Spoiled
oh
it for
my
everyone.
Gosh, it's been out for 2 years.
It is called The Last Song.
Yeah.
Now, there's a hint in title.
Well, it's like everybody, it's always somebody dies in the movie, and he's like, oh, I got headaches. And they're like, oh, dude, you're dead.
Brain cancer, tumor.
Yeah. The next one is Knights in Rodanthe, which is a little bit different than what it's normally, it's a little bit different than your normal Nicholas Sparks movie, but it's still, it's just excruciating because it's Richard Gere. And I love Diane Lane, but I'm sorry. She had to do this movie. And then the number one worst one is Dear John. That's the one that knocked Avatar off the top. Not necessarily because it knocked Avatar off, simply because it exists.
that's Channing Tatum, right?
Channing Tatum, 2012's bona fide box office star Channing Tatum was in Dear John, yes. And goddamn, can he not act? And then he's up against like,
Samina Seyfried. He's someone who's improved, and maybe he's picking roles that he realizes, you know, take advantage of his minimal acting talent. And he does have great comic timing. That's what's pretty impressive, is that
he's a good comedic actor. Yeah, I mean, he was great in 21 Jump Street, and he was very funny in The Dilemma. I think he really, really works. And he can play sort of the dumb lug, which he did in Haywire.
Yes.
But please don't act him to emote and cry. No. You know, G.I. Joe, that's like the pinnacle of his dramatic acting that you can do.
Yes. Is he even in a sequel? He's not in any of the trailers or...
No, he's in a hole in the sequel. He's hiding, I think.
Hiding?
There's a scene where everyone's getting blown up. He's kind of under something. You see his eyes.
Oh, okay. I just thought they might kill him off in the opening scene.
Maybe he's...
And then turn the entire film into Bruce Willis's character, you know, seeking revenge for the death of his younger brother or relative or whatever.
I don't know. I'll probably love G.I. I like the first one, even though it was absolute total shit. I like the first one. So this second one, it actually looks better. But anyways, yeah, Dear John, in the meantime, that's the worst Nicholas Sparks movie ever made. And then, of course, we got like honorable mentions like My Sister's Keeper or The Vow, which aren't Nicholas Sparks movies, but totally could be.
They're the formula. They fit the formula.
So anyways, let's move on. We got to go to a break. Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We had a pretty good middle segment. We were talking about a bunch of different things. We swerved into discussions of Michael Bay. We talked a lot about The Lucky One and how terrible that movie was. We also talked about The Fat Guy 5, which was the top worst Nicholas Sparks movies, and answered listener voicemail or listener email and discussed box office and what we think is going to win this coming weekend. Do you know what time it is? I forgot to prep you for this, but you got to talk about, don't you have to lead me in with the world famous DVD roundup? I have to say that now.
I do.
Say it. What's coming up next?
The world famous DVD roundup.
There we go. A whipping sound courtesy of the iPhone app.
It's good for something, finally.
You weren't expecting that. You were expecting my old school Lucasfilm effect. Anyways, real quick, let's go through the big releases. Probably the biggest release this week on DVD was Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. This was, of course, the fourth film in the franchise. Brad Bird. You liked this movie, didn't you?
I came very close to loving it, but maybe that's a slight exaggeration. Okay. Just because the story is just so by the numbers, threadbare, and you know.
It's a Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah, fairly weak villain. You almost felt like, what, they couldn't find a better actor or come up with a better villain, but they didn't really seem to care about that element of the story. But the action sequence
was awesome. Because it was awesome.
What's that?
Because the rest of it was so awesome.
Yes, well, the action sequences were absolutely superb. And that's Brad Bird's training and background as an animator and storyboards. Really fantastic. And on the IMAX screen, even better.
And to quote our good friend, Gray Drake from the Popcorn Mafia, so dope is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. The next one that's out on DVD and Blu-ray is Shame, a lighthearted romp through the life of a sexual addict.
An action film of a different kind.
Yeah, exactly. Different types of action. It is NC-17. Do not rent this and show it to the kids because it is...
Unless you want to scar them for life.
Yeah, it is like beginning to end, front to back, quite literally... an NC-17 movie. There is a lot of nudity in it. Now, we're, of course, in the radio segment, so we can't go into graphic detail. But the movie does go into graphic detail. But it is a fantastic film, independent film. and did not shy from the PG or the not PG well the NC-17 rating. So I applaud that.
It would have been a hard film to make if they tried to keep it to an R, even an R rating. I don't think they could.
I don't think they could edit it down.
No, I don't either.
It'd be tough.
Because some of the, you know, aside from the actual nudity, there's the element of just the intensity of it and the subject matter of sex addiction. Really, is not something that. Yeah, you don't want small children.
there would be around. An awkward discussion after seeing this movie. Yes. Let's just put it that way.
And Michael Fassbender was fantastic. He deserved an Oscar nomination. I was among those who was shocked he didn't get one.
I was not shocked, but I thought he deserved one. But.
And
I mean, it was
and if you're interested, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Movie. I was just saying it was an NC-17 sex addict movie that was an independent film. It wasn't going to get an Oscar nomination.
I thought it would possibly for him because he was just so tremendous in the role, and because he's been in so many different films, including, you know, X-Men: First Class last year, and you know he's really sort of up and up. He's going to be in Prometheus, but maybe his next role, his next serious role, he'll get the nod. And if you haven't seen that director, Steve McQueen's, no relation to our Steve McQueen, yeah. His first film, Hunger, I highly recommend it as well.
Cool. Two TV shows that are on DVD to check out, American Dad Volume 7. I like American Dad. The seventh volume, it's weakened a little bit. It's softened a little bit. It's not as uproariously funny, but it's still a neat little fun, goofy, very politically incorrect romp through American families. So there's that. There's also Bob's Burgers season one, which is the cartoon, the animated series that replaced King of the Hill on Fox in their animation block. So season one of that is on there. Funny show. Also Buck Privates, which is Abbott and Costello's their first real big Hollywood movie, feature length, and this is of course them going into the army. Now it released in 1941, but it was taking place in peacetime because we hadn't quite entered World War One or World War Two yet. It's notable because it's an assemblance of their sketches, really. So there's a loose story that follows them, but it's very famous for them as a comedy team. Also very famous because it is the movie that introduced the Andrews sisters singing "Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy" of Company B.
I did not know that.
And it's a neat little film. So check it out. It's on Blu-ray for the first time as part of the Universal 100th anniversary. And then the stinker of the week is Yo Gabba Gabba Super Spy, simply because have you seen Yo Gabba Gabba? It'll melt your brain. It is the most. It is Sid and Marty Krofft of the modern age for kids. So. And so that review wrap up, Chimpanzee, we neither of us saw, but we kind of both want to see. Yes. The lucky one, we get a totally sucks from both of us. Think Like a Man, I had a chance to see, and I said it kind of sucks. Next week, we've got Pirates, Band of Misfits. That's one movie. The 5-Year Engagement, The Raven, and Safe. Now we have Mel. Thanks again to Mel Valentin for coming on and talking to us. You've got about 30 seconds left. Tell us where you are, who you are, where we can find you, and all that nasty detail.
Well, you can find me on efilmcritic.com, sfstation.com, very aware. And you can also find me on Twitter as Theodore Fish, and that's a double F.
It's FYODOR. It sounds like you said Theodore Fish.
You're right, yes.
Theodore Fish is what I always say.
Theodore Fish.
And if you listen to us, and if you go on Twitter on Saturday nights, we always live tweet a movie, so you can join in on Saturday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern. But Jess, Mel, thank you for being on the show. Glad to have you on again, and we will talk to you guys later.
Yeah, thank you very much.